Welcome. My name is Rick Gibson, Associate Vice President for Public Affairs here at Pepperdine University, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this edition of Pepperdine People Online. Our host this week is Dr. Jerry Rushford. He's Professor of Religion and Director of Church Relations here at Pepperdine University. And he sat down recently with his guest, Dr. Scott McKnight, to talk about his recent books, The Jesus Creed and The Real Mary. During their conversation, Rushford asked Dr. McKnight about the emergent church and those who are most influential in this movement. I think you'll find the conversation both thought-provoking and challenging. Dr. McKnight visited Pepperdine as the 2007 Frank Peck Distinguished Christian Scholar on January 9th. Let me invite you to listen in now to this conversation with Dr. Scott McKnight.
Well, Scott, welcome to Pepperdine University. We're honored to have you.
Well, Jerry, good to be here.
You are an interesting observer of American Christianity from your perspective there at Chicago and at Willow Creek. Let's begin with, I think a lot of us know Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. You taught there for years. But North Park University, I'll have to admit, I didn't know the history there. Why did you move from Trinity to North Park?
It's a complex question because I think over 12 years of teaching at North Park, I've changed my mind on why I came. I think I was interested in teaching undergraduate students predominantly and thought the Lord was leading me more in the direction of undergraduates rather than seminary students. I enjoyed seminary, and I still would like to teach Greek exegesis, but I was ready to move to college, and I actually interviewed at Wheaton and was in the final two candidates at Wheaton. And then North Park called and asked me if I was interested, and I said, I'm definitely interested. Let's talk. And the more I talked to North Park, the more I thought, this is a place for me. Theologically, it's a little bit less defined. There's a ministry toward non-Christian students that I really enjoyed. There's a malleability about college students you don't have with seminary students. And I think those were the factors that led me into it. Over time, I've realized that it's more of a personality fit for me. I'm more playful and gamey in classrooms than seminary professors normally are. Mm.
Your first books all seem to be scholarly. You're writing to the academy. And then it looks like a change of direction or chemistry with the Jesus Creed. Was that your first popular book? Was there another
one? Definitely it was my first popular book. But I wrote A Light Among the Gentiles and Interpreting the Synoptic Gospels. And then I chose at that point, I made a decision not to spend all my time in the academy. I wrote two commentaries for Zondervan in the New International Version Application Commentary that sort of pushed me in the direction of writing for the church. Now, I don't think those were popular by any means, but they definitely were not academic monographs written entirely for the Guild of Scholars. But it was in the late 90s and the early 2000s that I began to consider writing books for lay people about Jesus. And, that was the big change then with Jesus Creed. Turning to Jesus, a book I wrote on conversion moved in that direction, but it was still...
The book on conversion was ahead of the Jesus Creed? You wrote
that? Yes,
that
would have been 2002.
Yeah.
And that book was written, that's still for pastors. It's not for lay people. Informed lay people, intelligent college graduates can read a book like that. But 225 pages on conversion is not a typical lay book.
Now, who published that?
That was Westminster John Knox Press.
Okay. Now, a book like The Jesus Creed, why wouldn't you give that to Baker or Erdmans or Zondervan?
I gave it to Zondervan, and Zondervan told me I wasn't famous enough at that time. I think now I have a contract to write two books with them. So at that point, I was an academic, and I wasn't known to lay people. And they trade with lay people at such a level that they expect their authors to be known, and I had to work at building a knowledge base, a platform, as it were. And so I gave it to Paraclete because I knew someone there, and it was a perfect fit for me. I really enjoy Paraclete with their ecumenical Christian Orthodoxy base, and so that's...
What is Paraclete Press? Is that Roman Catholic or Eastern Orthodox?
It's interdenominational, but it's an interdenominational liturgical press concerned mostly with spiritual formation in the great traditions. So they don't really market to evangelical Christians. They do. They're working more in that direction now. But they've always had readers who were Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and mainline Protestants and Episcopalians. And so, but they're interested in spiritual formation, and that's what Jesus Creed was.
What made you write The Real Mary?
5 years ago, I was teaching a class on Jesus of Nazareth at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I began the day by reading Magnificat, Mary's song, Luke chapter 1. And when I was done, I asked a question that I didn't have an answer to that came to me as I was talking that put me on a quest. And the question was this: what kind of woman would sing this kind of song when Herod the king, Herod the great, was the ruler of the land? And when I began to explore the question, I saw the Magnificat as coming from a woman with a lot of chutzpah and a lot of courage and a lot of faith. And I started to say, when I read books on Mary, when I read stuff about Mary, this is not the Mary I hear about. It's a Mary draped in a Carolina blue gown that is hyper-pious with her hands folded and looks milk-toasty. And I read the Magnificat, and I see a woman who seems with her sleeves are rolled up, and she's ready to go to battle with Herod the Great about justice in the land. And so I began to explore the pictures of Mary in Christian art and in Christian literature and said, I've got to write about this because nobody's writing about what I would call the real Mary of the Magnificat.
So no publisher came to you and asked for that book.
Well, Paraclete and I had talked about Mary. And one time I mentioned it to my editor, Lil Copan, and she says, oh, we'll do a book on Mary by you. Because I have a chapter in Jesus Creed about Mary. And in that chapter, I put out some of my ideas that I thought were pretty secure. And I said, I want to develop these ideas. And they said, we'll definitely do it. And then what happened is last May, I was having a coffee with John Wilson of Books and Culture and Mark Galley at Christianity Today in Wheaton, waiting for my wife to get out of work. And Mark told me that they asked me what I was writing on. I said, I'm going to write a book on Mary this winter. And Mark said, well, that's too bad because there's a movie coming out about Mary this fall. I didn't know about it. And I called my publisher as soon as I left the coffee shop, and I said, hey, there's a big movie coming out. Can we do Mary now? And they said, if I get them a manuscript by July 31st, they'll have it out.
And what date was this that they were talking?
This was in May. And so I had time. I mean, I knew where I was going to do because I had already been teaching the material.
But you had 8 weeks.
I wrote the book in 8 weeks. Yeah. I mean, I edited it hard. I wrote the book, the manuscript, in 4 weeks. And then I was at my desk every day from 7 to 4, 6 days a week. And I almost never write on Saturdays. And I didn't play golf all summer long because of it. But I knew that I had to get it done, and I cranked it out. I went through it as fast as I could to get my ideas out, and then I edited for another month, and then my editor beat it up pretty hard, and then I reworked it. And by, I think, about September 1st, that manuscript was completely done. I mean, it was all edited and ready to go to press.
And the movie came out when?
I think the movie was December 1.
And was the book out by then?
The book came out in November, yeah. Came out. And now my book is not about the movie. It's about Mary, and Mary comes up in the movie. And next December, I understand that Ben Fitzgerald, who wrote the screenplay for the Mel Gibson movie, has written a screenplay about Mary called Miriam that's going to be filmed in Jerusalem. It's being filmed right now, I guess. And next year, there's going to be a big movie on Mary. So it's a time to think about Mary, and it's time for evangelicals to think about Mary. We've wiped her off the map. She's nothing more than a piece in a Christmas creche that we unwrap December 1st, or in some people's house, November 1st, and then we wrap her back up January 1, and she's put away for the rest of the year. And I think we as Christians need to believe what the Bible says about Mary. And so, you know, I'm trying to get a conversation.
Now, I see that Christianity Today featured you on Mary in the issue just before Christmas. Was that an excerpt from the book? Or?
It was. As a result of reading the manuscript, the editors at Christianity Today decided they wanted to make that a feature article. But I had to adapt it. I couldn't just – they won't just print chapters from books. So I revised two of my chapters. And there's, it's a little bit unfortunate because it gives the image that Mary was just a subversive. And I believe the Magnificat subverts Herod the Great's injustices. But the book goes on to demonstrate that Mary had to learn that the subversion she thought was going to take place was not the kind of subversion that she thought was going to take place. It would take place not by taking over the crown in Jerusalem, sitting on the throne. It would take place by participating in a family of faith with Jesus at the center, and it would come through the power of the cross. And Mary learned those lessons.
But that's not in the article. So the article is more truncated and as a result more revolutionary, isn't it? A little more cutting.
I think that's right. There is a paragraph in there where I make it clear that Mary has things to learn. And I was grateful to get that lead article in CT for that Christmas to get some more thought about Mary. And I think a new image is the only kind of image evangelical Christians are going to embrace about Mary. I mean, I am persuaded that most evangelical Christians know what they don't believe about Mary rather than what they do believe about. They don't believe she's perpetually virgin. They don't believe in the Immaculate Conception. They don't believe she was assumed into heaven. They don't believe in any of that. But when you ask them what they do believe about Mary, they say, well, we don't believe about Mary because we're Protestants. And I'm convinced that we need to develop a new image of Mary so Protestants can bring her home. I tell my Roman Catholic friends that I've been to the Vatican in a Trojan horse, and at night I sneaked out and I stole a few images of Mary, and I'm taking her home to Protestants, and we're going to dress her up all anew.
Now, with the book coming out in November, the movie starting December 1, a month before Christmas, how are sales?
Good. I mean, you know, I don't call the publisher every week to see how they're doing, but I know it sold well, and I'm happy because it gives me courage that evangelical Christians are willing to take a look at Mary again.
Of all of your books, which one, and I don't know the answer to this, which one has sold the most?
Oh, Jesus Creed.
Jesus Creed
has
been
the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospel, I think, has sold. That's a dictionary, though.
Yeah.
But of my books that I wrote individually, Jesus Creed has sold the most.
Of all the books you've written, is there one that you would say, I'm most pleased I wrote that? Is there a favorite? Is there a book that you would say, I think I did my best work in that book, even though it didn't sell well?
My favorite book is always my last book and my next book.
So Mary's the last one.
That's my favorite book.
And what's the next one?
The next book, I have a book coming out probably next fall called A Community Called Atonement. It's a book on atonement theory, and it's a readable book on theology from Abingdon Press, and it argues that reducing atonement to penal substitution, to propitiation, is just – it's a mistake, is that we need to use all the clubs in our golf bag rather than just one. And so that's my next one. And then I'm writing a book this winter on fasting. And when I was asked to write the book on fasting, I asked the editor, I said, do I look like a faster? And she says, I don't really know what you practice, but she says, I want to know what you think. So
now who will publish the fasting?
The fasting book is going to be published by W in a series on the spiritual disciplines. Brian McLaren is writing a volume. Phyllis Tickle is the general editor. That's due August 17th.
How many different publishers? You're doing a book with Abingdon. You've done two with Paraclete. You've done John Knox Press.
This is kind of odd. I think I've published with all the major publishers in the Academy, other than university presses. I've published with Fortress, with Erdmann's, Westminster, John Knox, Baker, Zondervan, Baylor University Press, which is a fast-rising publisher, Abingdon. But all these are because of invitations. I didn't go to those publishers, and I'm happy to work with them. I find different publishers fun to work with.
Let's talk about American Christianity. The speech you gave at Westminster Theological Seminary, October 26, 27, on what is the emerging church, I must have downloaded that within 3 or 4 days. I mean, the word really spread that was a stimulating address. I hit the print button before I realized it was 30 pages and ran out of paper. But I immediately read it and sent it to several friends. How far did that am I mistaking that? Was that a hit, a stimulating moment where that went around?
Well, I have to admit, I mean, I don't have statistics, but I do know that book, that article, and that lecture was a fast-moving electronic issue. And I was getting letters from people all over the world, people in England, people in Australia, people in South Africa, United States, Canada, Europe. So it went fast, and I think I made a tactical mistake. I published it. I gave the lecture, and I allowed Westminster to publish it because they wanted to connect it. You know, they wanted to blog about it. And right away, Christianity Today contacted me, and they wanted to do it. But because it had been on the blog world, they couldn't feature it. So I've reworked it and cut it to less than half the size, and it'll be a feature article in February with Christianity Today, so it should come out any time, and it'll have one more point, so there's been some slight revisions.
But, now, would it be accurate to say you're not in the emerging church movement, but you're very favorable to it, open to it? They sort of see you as their theologian. What is your relationship with?
I'm in the emerging church movement.
Okay.
I'm definitely a participant confidently.
Okay, then I guess my question is, how do you do that and be a member at Willow Creek? I assume maybe you quite weren't in the emerging.
Well, it depends how you define emerging. I'm not emerging if that means I've withdrawn from the church and say it's a sinking ship and we're going to just participate in small boats all around the waters. I'm more of an emerging person in the sense of a theologian, and I believe in the emerging church ideas, and I believe these things have to be published and talked about and disseminated in the church so that we can make concrete changes to reach the next generation with the gospel. So I'm emerging in that way. I'm emerging in the sense that I support what's going on, and I like this idea of house churches. I like this idea of decentralization. I like the idea of training local people to do local things and to speak into local communities. So I'm very much for that. But we go to Willow Creek because that's our church. You know, I don't think that I'm going to change churches just because things are changing. I mean, this is where we go to church. If there were an emerging movement church in our area, we would probably participate and still continue to attend Willow.
So, how can I get a handle on the emerging church? Can I understand it theologically?
The key thing is to understand is that you cannot define emerging movement as a theological movement. So in other words, it's not like Churches of Christ have this doctrinal statement, Evangelical Free Church has this statement, the Evangelical Covenant Church has this statement, and the emerging movement has this statement. Let's compare the statements and see who's the best. That won't work with the emerging movement because it is not defined theologically. It's defined by its practice. It wants church to be defined on how it does church rather than by what it believes. So it's concerned with authenticity, with community, with a holistic gospel of reaching all kinds of people in all kinds of ways. There are postmodernist parts to it. Some people have a lower view of scripture in it. So some parts of the emerging movement to me are progressive Protestant liberalism. Some parts of it are adventurous evangelicalism. Mm-hmm. But you can't define it by its theology because you'll miss every time. There are a lot of people who don't agree with it. So Brian McLaren is one kind of emerging Christian. Spencer Burke is another kind of emerging thinker. And Scott McKnight is a different kind. Tony Jones is different. Doug Padgett. So you look at these different emerging leaders and you realize there are a lot of differences between these people. But what unites them is the attempt to try to figure out how to live as Christians and how to do church in our world. So they're trying to explore smaller church, more holistic gospel, and trying to affect the community rather than attract people to a building on a Sunday morning service.
Now, help me here. How do you take that and compare it with Robert Weber's book on the new evangelicals or the newer evangelicals? What does he see as the main themes? Who are the newer evangelicals? And are they not complementary to the emerging church movement? Are they the same people?
Well, Bob Weber's newer evangelicals is a combination of the Brian McLaren-type emerging movement with this young group of Christians following Bob Weber that have an ancient future faith. They're more interested in the ancient church traditions, the Orthodox calendar, the colors of the church year, and using traditional prayers rather than just spontaneous prayers, using traditional music, plugging into the great traditions of the church. Bob Weber combined those two groups in his newer evangelicals, younger evangelicals. And I think the emerging movement is really a separate movement. At one time, I thought there were two kinds of emerging Christians, ancient future emerging Christians and missional evangelical Christians. Now, I would not call the ancient future movement a part of the emerging movement so much. That's a traditional evangelical church that's gone ancient. And the emerging movement is actually moving forward in a new way of trying to figure out how to be a missional community in a local setting and let that local setting give rise to the kind of church it will be.
Now, do you think the emerging church would be stronger if it had some ancient element to it?
Well, I pray that the emerging movement will respect the great traditions of the church. Most of the leaders in the emerging movement have tremendous respect for the great traditions. They're not just burn it all down, burn the building down, and start all over. It's not that way. It is, this building is not working. We've got to get to the foundations, and we're discovering that in the foundations there's a lot of ancient faith there. So they're using ancient faith, but I see the ancient future movement of Bob Weber to be more connected to liturgical style and Sunday morning worship style, whereas the emerging movement does not want church to be equated with Sunday morning. They may not even gather on Sunday morning. They may gather on Sunday evening. They don't want it to be connected to, in other words, the traditional church connects church to Sunday morning. Preaching, worship, prayer, singing, choirs, Sunday school. The emerging movement wants church to be spread into the activities of Christians throughout the week in the community. Fascinating.
It really is fascinating. Who would you say right now is the most prominent face of the emerging church? Is it still Brian McLaren?
Oh, I think it's unquestionable it's Brian McLaren. It's just that Brian doesn't speak for the whole. If you ask me one figure in the United States that represents the centrist position of the emerging movement, it would be Dan Kimball up in Santa Cruz at Vintage Church.
Now, why? Why would you put him there?
Dan is less adventurous theologically. Dan has created he has verbalized the yearnings of the young generation for the kind of worship style and gatherings they want to have. Multitasking, definitely much more artistic, more sensitive to this younger generation, very concerned about space. So they don't like pews. They want this to feel like the kind of setting that will bring in the young generation. Coffee shops, art, you know, they use all the media to attract very informal, permeable walls, permeable boundaries between when we start and when we end. So I think Dan Kimball is the most centrist voice. Brian McLaren is the most public voice of the emerging movement. The leadership and director is Tony Jones in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So those are the three, I would say, the three most prominent voices.
Now, what were the three categories in Bob Weber's book? There was traditional.
A modernist, I would say pragmatic.
The pragmatic, that was it. Traditional was the Billy Graham model.
Yes.
The pragmatic was Bill Hybels, your pastor.
That's right. Yes.
And the newer evangelicals was Brian McLaren.
Brian McLaren.
Those were the three categories.
Yes. Bob Weber's category.
Now, would you see yourself as a bridge between Bill Hybels, your pastor, and Brian McLaren? Or do you sort of walk, you have a foot in both camps, or?
I probably, because of my age, 53, I have a foot in all three camps. I mean, it's unusual that I have a foot with Brian McLaren, because I think people at my age are connected to Billy Graham's form of the traditional church, mm-hmm. and with maybe, if we've accepted the seeker model with Bill Hybels' type model, it's unusual for someone in my shoes to be connected to the emerging model as well. But I think that the emerging church is telling us something we have to participate in. I think we have to listen.
Now, all the satellites that Willow Creek is establishing, are they more emerging church? I mean, Willow Creek is what, 22,000?
No, the satellite churches are largely just the piping in of the signal from Willow Creek into these other places. So it's the same.
Oh.
Yeah, the big change that took place in Willow in the last couple of years was they brought a dynamic pastor from Texas named Randy Frazee, pastor, a writer of a book called The Connecting Church. And Randy Frazee is the lead pastor in guiding Willow Creek into developing neighborhood anchors for the church so that everybody gets connected to a neighborhood rather than connecting to Wednesday night at Willow Creek, they call it New Community, or the weekend services. They are now trying to form their basic connection to their neighborhood. Now, that, to me, is an emerging model. They're realizing for this to work, we have to get into smaller communities of faith where authenticity and where we know one another, rather than this performance that takes place on the weekend with a great preacher, and we sit there and listen and maybe pipe in a few songs, and then we clap our hands or we say amen. We sing a song. We gather in our car and we go have a nice lunch with our family, and then we go home and take a nap. That's they're realizing that church is more about the authenticity of Christians living with one another in neighborhoods rather than simply what takes place on Sunday morning. So Willow is moving in that direction. And I hope churches start paying attention to what they're doing, because this, I think, can be revolutionary in the megachurch modernistic model. It can move in a direction that's emerging that will speak to local people in their local issues and their local communities.
Is it too simplistic to say that megachurches have peaked and they're sort of in decline? I mean, the megachurch may have 50 years ahead of it, but it's going to do more creative things like Willow is doing here?
I haven't studied megachurches, but I believe megachurches are connected to charismatic preachers. You know, they started, no matter how they started, if you don't have usually a great preacher connected to them, somebody that can mesmerize an audience once a week for 45 minutes, if you don't have that sort of preacher, I don't think you can have a megachurch. So I think megachurches will exist as long as you've got great, charismatic, mesmerizing preachers. We've got the mechanism to make that, to show that that sort of thing can work. So I don't think megachurches are going to fall by the wayside, because I think it's always interesting to listen to Max Lucado. It's always interesting to listen to Bill Hybels, to Mark Driscoll, to even Joel Osteen, who's got a different style for me altogether. But, I mean, these people are mesmerizing speakers and preachers. And I think as long as we've got those kinds of preachers, we're going to have mega churches.
As the house church movement grows, but that's going to affect the lack of church architecture, new buildings. Are we not going to be building large church structures? Is that sort of – or do you think – will the larger churches still enjoy large – facilities?
I think we'll keep having our regular churches, and I think Presbyterian churches are going to have some nice architecture, and Baptist churches are going to have bland architecture with a big pulpit. I think that's going to continue. I mean, we're probably never going to go to the wonderful days of all of our art being dedicated to the building of cathedrals, like St. Paul's or York Minster. The great ones in England, the great ones in Europe, St. Peter's in Rome. I don't think we're going to see that. One of my favorite churches I've ever been in is St. Francis, the Basilica of St. Francis in Assisi. I think it's just a marvelous structure of a Franciscan piety. But I don't think the emerging movement will do that. They will convert normal space into sacred space. So it's coffee shops, say the one in Seattle called Quest. It's a coffee shop that morphs into a church service. And it looks like a coffee shop, but they've got a band and someone talking up front. I don't think those kinds of things are here to stay. Those are a temporary transition as this young emerging generation finds its way into the best way to do church for the next generation, where there's a smaller, authentic bonding. And house churches definitely are not going to develop church architecture. But I don't think house churches are going to replace mega churches or traditional churches. I think that this is a model that's going to coexist.
Let's talk about books for a moment. What do you read, or what would you recommend that I read as far as, well, let's start with New Testament studies in your field. Is that an exciting field right now, or is it more exciting to go into theology or in spirituality? Or?
Well, it's always exciting to study the New Testament, but when you talk about the academy, there is not a lot of discovery going on in New Testament studies or in Old Testament studies right now. We saw marvelous developments out of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the rediscovery of Jewish sources. So all of a sudden in the 50s and 60s, we were studying Dead Sea Scrolls, the rabbinic writings, the Jewish pseudepigrapha, the Jewish apocrypha, and we mined those sources. And here at Pepperdine, you have one of the leading scholars in pseudepigrapha with Randy Chestnut. So you have these sorts of scholars have mined these sources, and they led to two major movements in New Testament studies. The historical Jesus studies. So Jesus studies burgeoned in the 80s. And in the 70s and 80s, there developed a thing in Pauline studies called the New Perspective on Paul, where we developed an understanding that Paul wasn't fighting legalistic Judaism, that Paul's understanding of Christianity was a kind of Judaism. And it was the development of an Old Testament faith. It wasn't the elimination of an Old Testament faith. Well, that gave rise to all kinds of dynamic studies. And the major leaders of the last 30 years, Ed Sanders, E.P. Sanders, Jimmy Dunn, N.T. Wright, Marcus Borg, John Dominic Cross, and these people have mined all those discoveries. And frankly, New Testament studies has come to a stalemate. It's a checkpoint. There's nothing new right now in New Testament studies. But the exciting part is theologians have picked it up, and they've begun to develop new theological grids in light of these great discoveries in New Testament and Old Testament studies. So we have Miroslav Volf, and we have Laurent Schultz, and these people have been given the freedom to make new contributions in theological studies that are really exciting. And I think the most excitement is taking place today in discovery with new paradigms shifting how we do theology and look at theology is in theology rather than in biblical study.
Scott, we're looking forward to the lecture tonight on the Jesus Creed. Tell me about that book.
In the Jesus Creed, I ask a very simple question that came through teaching for years, Jesus of Nazareth, to college students. I asked this question: how would Jesus have understood spiritual formation? Now, that spiritual formation is our term today for Christian life. So how would Jesus have conceptualized the Christian life in his world? And I don't think he would have talked about the spiritual disciplines, because he didn't. He didn't talk about it that way. I think he would have understood the Christian life the way, following Jesus, the way Jews did in the first century. And so I explore a Jewish understanding of the Christian life by asking the simple, by looking at the very simple standard Jewish practice of reciting the Shema every morning every Jew, every evening, every Jew said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." It's called the Shema because in Hebrew it begins with the word Shema, hear. Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 5. When Jesus was asked by a scribe, what is the great commandment? Sort of like Snow White, who is the fairest of them all. Jesus says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength." And then he added something. He said, "And love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these two." And Matthew tells us that all the commandments hang from these two. Jesus believed that the 613 prohibitions and commandments of the Old Testament were all divided, could be divided into, they're either about loving God or loving others. And he believed the essence of spiritual formation was to become a person who loved God and love others. So the Jesus Creed is an attempt to explain the teachings and life of Jesus in light of the Jesus Creed of loving God and loving others. So that's what I call the combination of the Shema with Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself, the Jesus Creed. Kind of clever, don't you think?
Yeah, that's great. What about the impact of the emerging movement on mainstream Christians, on those people who are not attending anywhere right now, or lay people, or just the unchurched generally? Is it having an impact? How?
Well, it's grassroots, and so it's not something that we have church statistics on. I mean, we know how many people are now attending Evangelical Covenant churches that weren't last year. We don't know how many emerging churches, how many people these emerging churches have impacted. But Dan Kimball just wrote a book. It's coming out within another couple months with Zondervan. I think it has a title something like this, "Give Me Jesus, But Not the Church." There's a generation that knows it doesn't like the church, that it doesn't like Christianity, but it thinks Jesus is great. And I think the emerging church movement, wants to offer Jesus to the culture and to their neighborhood and to their friends, whether that becomes a church or a new building is not the point. I got a letter recently from a man who works as an underground missionary in Afghanistan. And I don't know how he does this, but he's involved. And he talked to a man one day who was talking about Jesus. And the man said he doesn't like the church. And this Christian said, "Well, that's fine. Jesus came to build the kingdom. What do you think the kingdom is about?" So the man began to talk, and before long he realized this man was almost a Christian when it came to his perception of Jesus. And so I think that there's a lot of people in that condition in our culture. I find people fascinated by Jesus today. Look at the number of books on Jesus in Barnes & Noble bookstores. I don't know what your big bookstore out here on the West Coast, but in the Midwest, Barnes & Noble is big. Crocs and Brentano. There are shelves of books about Jesus. But if you put up a section of books about the church, there wouldn't be as many people interested in it. So I think the young generation is interested in Jesus, and I think this emerging generation is offering Jesus to that church.
Let me close with this. David Edwards, who we talked about earlier from the Church of England, wrote the book, The Futures of Christianity. We had all these books that came out in 2000 as we moved into the third millennium, The Futures of Christianity. And they pretty much all agreed that in this century, the 21st century, when we're at the end of it and looking back, would be known as the century of the coming together of the various strands of Christian communities. Not that Protestants and Catholics would completely merge or Orthodox, but a lot of walls going down, a lot of coming together. Their reasoning, because the opposition to the faith would increase and we would be driven into each other's arms as the intensity of opposition mounted. Christians of all stripes would find common ground and come together. How do you react to that?
Unless they're saying that there's a Muslim menace in the world I see that as the only possibility of that sort of opposition to the church. And I don't see it that way. I don't see the clash of civilizations that way. I could be wrong. I do not believe that the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church can combine with evangelical Protestants and mainline Protestants. Not until the Pope is willing to sit down with Billy Graham. And that's not happening. Not until the Patriarch of Constantinople is going to sit down with the Pope and say, we're going to drop our differences. So, Jerry, you and I can get together with a local Catholic priest and an Orthodox priest, and we can sit at a table and say, you know, we're really good guys. We agree on most things, don't we? That's fine, and it's wonderful to get together for conversation like that, but that is not going to bring these groups together. I believe there's only two ways it can happen, through power. And that power being the major figures sitting down with one another and saying, we're going to drop our differences and we're going to learn to get along. Or a young generation says, we're not putting up with it. And at the grassroots level, actually creating alternative churches that are genuinely ecumenical but based in gospel living, so that the emerging church can actually combine and create a post-Catholic, post-Orthodox, post-Protestant church. If enough grassroots-level churches start at that level, you could wipe denominations, the major traditions, off the map. But I don't think that can happen either. I just don't think there's enough people like that. And I don't think the authority figures are going to get together and change. So I think we're here for another century of living with major great traditions living apart from one another. It's not very hopeful, is it?
Well, but it's stimulating to talk with you. Thank you for having time for the conversation. We're looking forward to the lecture tonight on the Jesus Creed. And hope you'll come back to Pepperdine again.